Live listeners and later listeners. And welcome to The Big Web Show, episode number 125, an historic episode, a milestone episode. 125, I'm here today with the author of A Book Apart, number 12, You're My Favorite Client. He's the artist, a designer, author, lecturer, and famous beard cultivator, Mr. Mike Montero. Hi, Mike.
Hello, Jeffrey. How are you?
I'm good. How come I have a cold, but you sound scratchy?
I have a cold, too.
Oh, you do?
I just haven't had mine since 1963, like you have.
Yeah. I think I've had mine since December 26th.
1963. The day after Christmas.
No, this last year. I brought I took my daughter to the airport. I left her with her, and I... It came back during the snowstorm. I was finally over it, but it came back during the snowstorm a couple of days ago. So
this is great. This is great radio. Two old guys talking about colds.
I've got mucus.
This is good.
And I'm in pain when I stand.
Yeah, you want to join me for dinner at 3 o'clock this afternoon?
I love dinner at 3 o'clock. It's my favorite thing.
I bet you do.
You're lucky. You're married. I have to try to find someone to date at 3 o'clock.
Oh, come on. We're like 3 minutes in and we're already there. Let's talk about some design stuff.
Let's talk about some design stuff. Before I do, I want to thank our good friends at Thinkful who are sponsoring today's show, and I'll have more to say about them in a moment. But first, the name of the book is You're My Favorite Client. This is a book addressed not to designers, but to the people who hire designers, which is unusual. And it is dedicated to Leslie Harpold, who taught me how to write a thank you note.
You remember Leslie?
I remember her very well, but for people who are under 40, can you elaborate?
Leslie was one of the pioneers of the web and of writing on the web. She was a damn good writer, a great designer, she gave fantastic advice,
and she believed in you as a writer.
She did, like, and we miss her dearly.
We do miss her dearly. She was one of the first people putting independent content on the web, not looking for sponsors, not looking for a monetization plan, just overjoyed at the notion that she could publish original content and share it with the world, and that's what she wanted to do.
She was one of the smartest, kindest, sweetest people I knew.
And died a few years ago, tragically and pointlessly.
Yeah.
Right? Basically from a cold. This is setting a very ominous tone, but she was alone. She had a bad virus, and it got worse, and that was it. She was 38 at the time or something crazy like that.
Yeah.
Maybe. Horrible. So welcome to the show.
Uplifting show. So far.
Did Leslie teach you about client services? Did she? Why? Or you just love her and wanted to dedicate this book to her?
Leslie, there was a great piece that Leslie wrote, which about how to write a thank you note. Do you remember that?
Was that in her magazine?
I think she wrote it for the Morning News, which I believe is still around.
The Morning News is definitely around, yeah.
Leslie understood, you know, the power of being gracious and the power of being good to people and writing a good thank you note. And it was a lesson that I've never forgotten from her, taking the time to do things like that, which I think is something that's invaluable in client services.
She also carried item like restaurant bills and taxi cab receipts. She carried all kinds of things. So if you did something that was tax deductible as a freelancer and forgot to ask for a receipt or whatever, you could fill it out. So basically, to help us with our taxes, because she was a grown up too. She was a grown up in a world of babies. Because I think she and I were among the older of the people that were people who had done other things before they started doing web content, whereas a lot of the people that we were with at the time, hanging with and admiring the work of, were like 19, and they'd never done anything else. They'd like shoveled their dad's driveway and then won a best show at the Webbies or something. Like,
so on my desk, I have an unopened pack of Desert Storm trading cards that they were put out by Topps during Desert Storm in the 90s. Leslie designed those.
Wow.
Did you know that?
I did not. I know she was involved in the Garbage Pail Kids.
Yeah, she did those too.
And incredible.
Then she went to the web.
Well, she'd already achieved things. Designing Desert Storm cards, I mean, there's so much. I'm kind of overwhelmed by that thought. And we could do a whole show on that, but we're not going to. Getting into the subject of your book itself, one of the things that you say over and over, you explain to clients, which is beautiful, is that design makes you money. The design is not... Do you want to elaborate on that?
Well, of course. I mean, the goal of design is to put asses in seats.
And sell product.
Yeah. Everything, I mean, the whole reason that people hire us is because they want to achieve a goal, which is usually either selling something or, you know, drawing this crowd over here, or, but it's a very measurable goal for the most part. And that's what we need when we're doing our jobs. We need to keep that goal in mind. And that's how we want the work to be measured. And we have to make sure that that we're keeping the client keeps that in mind as well.
Do you remember, it wasn't that long ago, when you basically had to sell the client on the return on investment of design, almost like it was an optional extra feature, like comfy cushion seats, or, you know, you want air conditioning. Design is like air conditioning. You don't need it. You can still drive across the desert, but it'll make it nicer. I mean,
right. I think
you remember that?
Yeah, I think that was the stupid dark ages of design when we sold it as an investment. It's not. I mean, when I think of an investment, I think of like an extra thing or an add-on or something that, you know, I keep mint in box until it increases in value. We need to sell design as a core foundation of what you're doing. It's like when you're building, that you have a strong foundation before you have anything else. And that's where design fits in. It's in the foundation.
It's the house. It's not the paintings on the wall of the house.
Exactly. We were selling it like it was, you know, after you've built it and after you've done everything else, after the engineering and after, you know, the architecture, then maybe come in and, you know, add some design to it.
What are those people that sell really expensive plumbing, like really expensive bathtubs and stuff? Is it Noel? But they have, like, you know, Bathroom by Noel or Powder. They sort of sell it like, you don't want to just use any toilet. You're rich. You want to use a toilet that pampers you. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Where are you hanging out?
These are just Wealthy People magazines that you might see while in a client's waiting room or in a doctor's waiting room. And, you know, or you might, you know, if you, I used to get Architecture Digest because I thought it was about architecture. It actually isn't. It's about wealthy lifestyles. And like all the architecture magazines I've seen are really about wealthy lifestyles and showing off your house. But I thought they were about architecture, and I'm passionate about architecture. So, you know, but I remember, like, you know, kind of Body by Noel type. Not Noel, a guy. K-N-O-L-L.
They don't have those magazines at the socialist bookstore that I go to.
You're in the People's Republic of Berkeley, or I thought you were in San Francisco.
I am in San Francisco, which used to be the People's Republic of San Francisco, and now it's correct. Just an Ayn Rand state.
I live in New York, so I know, and I've stayed in New York City there was a period, right, where we lived was lawless and filthy, but we loved it. And then we started growing up, at least I started growing up and going, it's kind of nice that the streets are safer now, because I'm a little more conservative than I used to be. And I don't want I don't want someone shot on the street and think I'm being glamorous because I walk past and act cool. I'm glad that it's safer. And then it sort of went past that into, Hi, if you are a Saudi billionaire looking for an apartment to buy for $5 million, just as an investment perhaps for your son when he comes to the country for a couple of days a year, why don't you buy this building? And yeah, and so everybody's, the people that moved to Brooklyn are now, we're moving to Philly, and now they're thinking, I don't know where they're going to go. Like, I don't know where humanity is going. Well, humanity seems to be moving away from our cities unless you can compete on a very high financial level. How do you do that, by the way, as a designer? Because you're not in the big tech company business, right? You're not Facebook. You're not Twitter. You're Mule Design. You run a small design studio. How do you guys survive in San Francisco economically?
Very tenuously. We're a small shop. We try to keep a low overhead. We live in a rent-controlled apartment.
Oh, nice. They still have that?
For now.
They don't have that in New York anymore.
Really?
Yeah, they got rid of that. And they had rent stabilization, but then once rent got to $2,000, they can charge anything they want. So it goes from like $2,000 a month to $4,000 a month. So then you basically have to buy, which means if you're lucky enough to have a windfall in the bank, you can put a deposit down and I'll finish paying for my home when I'm 93. Somehow the bank gave me a loan. I don't understand how they think I'll be contributing at a high level at 93, but it's okay. It's okay by me. So, I guess they'll take it back at the end. So I'm just renting at a more high cost. But so you have kind of a research, like you're talking about in the book, you don't just take a job and go off and be inspired and wait for the muse. You go off and figure out what the problem is and then figure out how to solve it. Do you ever find clients who resist this way of doing things? Clients who
not big seats.
You have clients who say, like, I just want the magic. I just want you guys to blue sky it.
No, we have potential clients that say that. And the trick is to not take them on as clients.
How do you... So basically, the trick is to keep everyone on payroll while being selective.
Yeah, I mean, we're small. We're small on purpose. And it's so that we know we can do well. And turn down the jobs that we know won't work for us. There's always going to be somebody out there who's willing to blue sky something. That's just not us. So we interview our clients basically,
right?
Or that they're the right type of client for us.
Now, some people hearing that will think. I don't think this, but some people hearing that will think, well, those guys are arrogant or those guys are at the top of the pyramid. So, of course, they can afford to interview their clients, I can't.
That's not arrogant at all.
Okay.
We want to make sure that the people who we're promising we will do good work for you are actually people that we can do good work for. If we took on somebody that wouldn't fit the way, you know, our research methodology, then we would be doing them a disservice.
Do you ever think, you know what, I'll take it and just make it pretty, that's fine. I'll take the money, it's a quick hit. People just want me to make it pretty, I can do that?
Nope.
Do you hate pretty?
No, I love pretty. But you know what's better than pretty? It's pretty good. We want to make things work. So here's how I define design. Design is the solution to a problem within a set of constraints. So to actually design something, we need to study it. We need to figure out how it needs to work. We need to figure out who's going to use it, how they're going to use it, and then design it in a way that fits how those people work and fits how the organization that's hiring us is going to interact with it as well.
Right. So you have to understand the company and you have to understand the people there. You have to be a therapist. You have to be somewhat have a business head. So what is Dribbble then? Keeping in mind that we love Dribbble and Dan Cederholm, co-founder of Dribbble, is a friend of the show. Is Dribbble design or is it something different?
I don't use Dribbble personally. I've looked at it. I've stolen ideas from it.
right?
Like any good designer would. I see Dribbble as, you know, a place where, you know, designers go to play with effects and colors and crap. I mean, there's definitely value in that, but I don't think that's not what our company does.
That's not, so that's visual play, that's a component of design, that's the aesthetics, yeah. a component of design.
Visual play is a really good way to phrase that. And there's certainly value in that.
And yeah, I totally get off on that stuff.
That's certainly a part of what we do here. But we don't separate that out from the rest of the work.
When you started as a designer, though, wasn't that what design was to you? Do you remember like being a designer? Do you remember
of course underground? I do.
Yeah, okay. And like, so you'd like look at tattoos and you know what I mean? And like that was your design discussion, or talk about like an effect that worn weathered look?
Do you remember when Michael Jordan went out and tried, you know, scoring 60 points a game every night? And then he realized that it was more fun to win championships.
That's a sports thing, right? So you lost me, but...
Oh, come on.
I'm serious.
Okay, so...
I really was not socialized that way. I'm like David Bowie in The Man Who Fell to Earth. Nothing against it. I wish it had been part of my upbringing, but it's just like my uncle's into the ballet and I have the same feeling about ballet. It's like I can look and go, wow, those athletes are really impressive, but I don't get it as entertainment. I can't get excited about it. Maybe it's because the only sports I was shown were like baseball, and this was in the 60s and 70s. And it was like, I saw the Mets. I was living in Connecticut, visiting New York and watching the Mets drop. And they were like worse than me. Like we would watch a ball come right to a guy, go right toward his glove, and then somehow miss his glove, and the guy would bump heads with another guy, and then they'd both fall down, and people were throwing hot dogs and stuff. And I just never, and I've been to baseball games since, and it just seems like you sit out in the sun, and it's now they're better players, but they just, I don't know, the pitcher strikes everybody out, so I don't get it. It's like watching someone not play chess,
right? You know, so. As a young designer coming up,
yeah. I mean,
you're fascinated by, you know, the aesthetics and making things pretty and all that stuff,
right?
Is great, and that's the stuff that that most people think of as design. But the more you do it, and the more you work with other people, and the more experience that you have with clients, and the more you understand why clients are actually hiring you, that understanding of design broadens and deepens, and It's like a series of moments through your career where you actually understand what your role is and what your job is with these people. I mean, nobody goes to a website because it's pretty.
Nope.
Has never happened ever.
Mm-hmm.
Nope.
I'm trying to think of some young designers do.
We're soldiers, not civilians.
So we went, like, I went to K10K because it looked so awesome. Right? You remember Caliber 10,000? It was a wonderful site, and it was for us. But, you know, and there was also content. The content was good. But it was mainly just this complete illustrated world and this, you know, this complete aesthetic universe that it was like watching Miyazaki or something. It was like someone had a complete set of aesthetics, this team, right? Toka and Michael and later Mike Buzzard had, and Per had this, you know, they had this aesthetic and the sense that web interfaces were playful and pixelated and everything. And it was awesome. Mm-hmm. So yeah, but we're right. We're civilians. People don't go to Gap.com because it's pretty. They go to Gap.com to buy underwear.
Right.
It has to be.
And
go ahead.
Our job is to make it easy for them to buy underwear and to make it as pleasant an experience as possible. And also from the client side, I mean, that helps the client as well. What the client is in the job of selling underwear.
So how do you feel about designers calling themselves UXers instead of designers, almost to differentiate so the client understands that they want to do the thing you're talking about.
That's a self-loathing term.
Is it? Because it's almost like if I call myself a designer, you'll think I hit things with a pretty stick. So the only way you will understand is if I say I'm a UX person, then you go, oh, you're sort of a business person who solves problems. I get it.
Do you remember when we tried legitimizing comic books by calling them graphic novels?
Yeah. Oh, here's my favorite. I got the Archie app, right? Archie Comics app. They actually call all their comics Archie graphic novels now. And they call them that in a headline that's like set in Comic Sans with black outline text around it and then has like vibrating psychedelic patterns behind it. So it's basically, if you were a client who knew a few Photoshop tricks and designed your own logo, but then, and you did that for Archie, but then you called it graphic novels. It's like the pretentious, it's Archie. Like, I can't think of anything less graphic novel. Arguably Ghost World is a graphic novel. I like calling it a comic, but you could, you know, Ghost World, you could call it that, or this horrifying thing I'm reading now by Charles Burns about all these people who have wounds appearing on their bodies for some reason. Reading Kafka. What?
That's why you're sick all the time, because you're reading Charles Burns.
I've been reading Charles Burns since the 80s.
I met Charles Burns once.
You did? That's so cool. I would love to meet Charles Burns.
I played croquet in his backyard.
Get out of here.
No, seriously.
Where does he live? I mean, what town?
Well, at this point, I'm not sure if he's still there, but it was in the Philadelphia suburbs. His wife was a teacher at Tyler School of Art. That's how we met.
He did Dog Boy in Raw Comics. Raw, by the way, called itself Raw Comics, started by Art Spiegelman. They didn't call themselves graphic. But okay, so we're talking about labels. I have a pet peeve about designers feeling like the word designer isn't good enough. I've always had this pet peeve because Lord knows our industry is filled with an ever-changing panoply of titles. And I don't want anyone who is a UX person or whatever to take this as an insult, what we're saying. This is just personal stuff. Can I tell you what bothers me about design and like what encapsulates everything that I think people hate about design? So there's this gorgeous t-shirt for Shopify designed by Mike Coos that says design is at the heart of everything we do. And it's got this human heart and it's beautiful. It's visually beautiful and it's made to appeal to designers. And I got it for my daughter because she likes to wear kind of funky designed t-shirts. And I love the artistry of Mike Coos. I love Shopify. Like, I want to give everybody their due. I hate that shirt too, because to me, it's that I'm a designer. I see things a little differently than you. I knew I wanted to be a designer when I was 4 and I was drawing. And my father said, why not use the red crayon? And I rolled my eyes. And then I knew that's what I wanted to do professionally. Roll my eyes. Do you know what I mean? that feeling like you are a shoemaker, I believe. You know what I mean? That sort of preciousness about design that we all buy into at times. My kid actually has a routine making fun of me, basically, when I do it. And it's become something that now I also see and loathe in us. That's sort of like, yes, I'm sorry, the kerning. I can't really pay attention because with kerning like that, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I feel like there's a whole Zoolander-esque movie to be made about, instead of male models, about designers. Yeah. So I'm not that kind of designer. And it doesn't mean I don't have aesthetic. It doesn't mean I don't love beauty. It just means I hate that pretentiousness in myself.
Why are we handing the word over to the people who do it badly? That word has a lot of history to it. What did Massimo Vignelli call himself?
He called himself a graphic arts practitioner. No, he called himself a designer.
What did Ray and Charles Eames call themselves?
They called themselves evangelists of, they call themselves designers.
Yeah. All of these, I mean, we've got an amazing, design has an amazing history with these wonderful people who, you know, did this fantastic work that we should all be looking at every day. And all of those people were designers. And now all of a sudden, we've got, you know, a bunch of millennials who have been doing this for like 3 or 4 years who have decided that the term isn't good enough for them anymore.
It's not millennial. I mean, I remember this stuff happening in the 90s.
And I just like giving them shit.
Oh, okay. But I was speaking at AIGA Miami in like 1998, and Thomas Caspers where did Karen McGrain start? It starts with an R. Famous place.
Razorfish?
Yeah, Thomas Caspers, the executive creative director at Razorfish, gave a talk on how they had cut down their time like 72 to 36. In other words, there were no longer 72 different words that meant basically designer. There were now 36 at Razorfish. They were very pleased to have consolidated. I'm painting this in a really ugly way, but basically they had, you know, our directional bifurcative experience controllers. I mean, they had all these titles that basically meant design, but I guess like, maybe they meant the person who makes wireframes and does nothing else. The person who conducts research interviews and does nothing else.
Yeah, I'm just happy to call myself a designer and move on.
Do you do all the stuff? When you talk about design, you know, beginning with research and testing ideas, there's a section in your book where you talk about trouble with startups because you love startups and you love the idea of the passion of someone who thinks about something so much and envisions it so completely that they end up quitting their job and trying to put it in the world. You think that's great, but that you've had some difficulty having places like that as a client when they weren't really ready to kick the tires of their idea. That was their baby. Yeah.
So in my experience, I have found it easier to work with startups once they've gotten that initial idea out of their head and actually made it. And once they've come back and said, hey, this didn't work exactly like I thought it would. Now, can you help me?
So because Twitter and Facebook, not some real startup, a tech company that's successful.
Or not successful.
But at least has launched something.
Right.
That's also when they tend to have money, which is nice.
Yeah. But or I mean, not. If you believe in something so much that you're going to like quit your job and throw all of your eggs in this basket and you've been like seeing this thing in your head and for like years and now you're finally going to go do it. This is not the time when you want to listen to somebody else telling you that's not going to work so well. Or what if you tried it this way instead?
There's a lot of voodoo research, not in design, but just generally. Like if you've been in advertising, there's a lot of self-fulfilling prophecy that comes from like focus groups. And I think some people are just, I think the reason some creatives are precious about their ideas is that they've seen really wonderful ideas killed by you know, by a focus group that really was just trying to guess that the person leading it had a bias and that the people participating in it were trying to guess what the bias was so they could give the right answer and get their sandwiches. Yeah. And that it had nothing to do with actually research.
I was on a panel once with some guy who was in charge of a startup, and I actually forget who it was. But I asked them if they actually did any research before they started designing their product. And they said no, because then I would have to do what the people told me.
Wow.
Which was amazing to me that people thought that way.
He didn't want to succeed with this product. He wanted to get it built the way he had imagined it.
Right. So in his mind, research told him how to design something. And the way that I usually explain this to people is research tells you how not to design something. There's still, elaborate. You know.
What do you mean?
Hello? What?
Yeah, what do you mean? What do you mean?
So research tells you, like, tells you what to avoid. It tells you what won't work. And it points you towards what will work. And you as a designer still have a lot of leeway in what you're doing.
Okay. How do you know when you've done enough research?
When you've got something that you feel comfortable putting in front of people.
You've talked about, you keep going back to data and research a lot in this book. Is that because you believe in it or because it makes this an easier sell to clients?
No, I actually do believe in it. And I don't, I also think, you know, there's room for gut in all of this stuff.
Okay, but you say subjectivity is weak. I quoted you on Twitter about an hour ago, something you said in the book that I love, which is that your subjectivity is not a, your taste is not, your personal tastes are not a success metric.
Your personal tastes are not a success metric.
Right. So,
that goes for clients as well as designers.
Right.
Like, When you start working on something, or when you're evaluating something that a designer is showing you, you need to go back to the original goals that were set. Let's stick with our selling underwear goal because that was so charming. And you need to evaluate this thing. This is actually going to sell underwear or not. Not, you know, whether do you like it or are those my favorite colors? And, you know, the designer needs to design it with that goal in mind as well. Needs to evaluate it with that goal in mind. And, you know, what the book is about is helping clients to figure, giving clients the language to do that and helping them figure out how they're actually getting good design and how to find out if it's good design. And how to make sure that they're working with somebody who has their best interests in mind.
Because a client doesn't know that. They know how to make underwear. They know how to sell underwear. They know how to price underwear. They don't know how to evaluate design of a website. It's not their job.
Why would they? It's not their job. I mean, and, you know, for my, I have seen, you know, the problem with designers is they, you know, one of them is that they forget that they're working with clients who don't have a design background. And they, you know, they get irritated. They're not giving me the right kind of feedback. They're, you know, saying dumb things. And at the same time, they're not behaving as the expert that the client hired. So they give away their power in that relationship by, you know, asking the client incredibly subjective questions and, you know, talking about typefaces for an hour during a presentation instead of just owning those things. And having given away that power, they're then irritated that the client has attempted to fill the void which they made.
To be fair to designers, though, it's very frustrating to have really worked hard on something and to know in your gut one solution is better than the other, and to be able to explain perfectly well why, and then have the client say, I like the other.
Then don't show the other. Don't show the other one. I have been in this situation before, and I have, you know, like you promise people three directions, and you're working on them, and you know that one of them is the right one. And I've been in the position where you show them all three and you're going, pick this one, pick this one, pick this one.
And they never do. And
they never do. And
they pick the safe thing that looks like other things they've seen. It looks like their competitor. Right.
So, you know, eventually what I started doing is I don't show the other ones. I just show the one that I am most confident. I sell the hell out of it and I convince them that this is the one that will work. This is the one that we need to take a chance on. These are the reasons why it will work. And I figure that's why these people have hired me.
Well, if anyone could do that, it is Mike Montero, because this whole book, You're My Favorite Client, And you're talking to the toughest person in the room. This book is written to a client. It's confidential. You lean in, you joke with them, you get it from their point of view, but you're arguing with, you're persuading, you're engaging with a client in sentence after sentence after sentence and argument after argument. Witty and knowing, and not everyone can do that. While you think about that, I want to take a quick break to thank today's sponsor. Today's Big Web Show is hosted by our friends at Thinkful. Not thankful, Thinkful. I love that name. I wish I came up with that name. I'd have to come up with a product, but I love the name. Learn to build websites and apps in 3 months with HTML, CSS, JavaScript, and jQuery. It's a one-on-one mentorship, which means just what it says. You're working with someone. They're working with you. You work at your own pace. It's customized to what you need. It's a multiple skill levels, right? So you might be a designer who wants to learn code. You might be a really good at, I mean, for me, you know, like I'm pretty confident. Well, I used to be pretty confident with my design and HTML and CSS skills. Never confident about my JavaScript. So for me, I could do something like this to just like get up to speed on JavaScript and jQuery. I admitted that. We all have something we're not especially good at. And this is a chance to polish all your skills and bring them up to snuff. You can build a job-ready portfolio if you don't have one of those. You can build a job-ready portfolio if you don't have clients who've read Mike Montero's book and you're not in a position where you're confident selling and you don't have a lot of good work to show for yourself, so you have to make some. This is a good place, a good way to learn to do that. For 10% off, go to www.thinkful.com/bigwebshow. That's thinkful.com/bigwebshow. For 10% off, one-on-one mentorship leading to a job-ready portfolio, building websites and apps in 3 months. Host from our good friends at Thinkful. Thank you, Thinkful. Thank you, Thankful. Okay. And we're back. There are designers who, Mike, who just have an incredible aesthetic taste, who can just move elements around on a page and keep moving elements around on a page until they're perfect, but aren't necessarily articulate about things or aren't necessarily good at business schmooze. How did you get good at that? And how do you advise designers to get good at that?
By accepting that it is part of your job. It is a core part of your job. If you do really, really great work and you can't convince somebody that it's really great work, then you might as well not have done it. And two, practice. I have been doing this for a very long time. I was terrible at it when I started. I remember throwing up before client presentations and, you know, getting up in the front of the room and, you know, my heart being in my throat and just being terrified. And then, you know, a client would ask me a hard question and I would fold like a house of cards. That's all perfectly normal. But I knew that if I wanted to survive, I had to get better at that stuff.
Now, you grew up watching your mom, who's a seamstress, make bridal gowns for brides. I think this is mentioned somewhere in the foreword.
Yeah, that's in the book.
It's in the book. And this helped you learn client services, learn design.
Yeah, these women would come to the house and, you know, it was like a whole social event with my mom. Like, you know, there'd be wine and, you know, we would always get shuttered off to our room.
Sit on the stairs.
Exactly. We'd sit on the stairs and we'd peek, but there was like a whole social event, like getting to know each other, like being friendly, you know, sharing a joke, here's some local gossip about somebody we both know. And, you know, eventually they'd get down to, you know, talking about bridal gowns. But
it sounds very Middle Eastern. It sounds like if you've ever bought carpets in Turkey, which I have, I mean, that's how business is done. You're Portuguese in ancestry, so I guess that's Mediterranean. Maybe it's just a maybe just all the different travelers who lived on the Mediterranean developed African side or European side.
Yeah, it could be. But, you know, that's how I learned that client services worked. There was a whole relationship that went before getting down to business. And, you know, there was a whole level of honesty and bluntness that also happened with that, because, you know, my mom had to tell people that they weren't a size 4. They were actually a size 6.
Right.
And that's something that you'd have to carefully manage, that kind of information. But
you don't seem to have you seem good at bluntly telling the truth in a way that doesn't offend the person you're talking to.
Yes.
They respect you.
Yeah. That's why people hire me. They hire me to tell them the truth. And it's my job to tell them the truth. Can you imagine if you took your car in and your mechanic found that your brakes were cut or your brakes were shot, but they were afraid to tell you that because they didn't want to upset you, you know, want the price to get higher, or you know, they didn't want you to, you know, cry. You have to tell people that. So, you know, you don't have to be a dick while you're doing it. You figure out like, what's the best way for me to give my client this information, which could possibly, you know, save their business.
But in your comparisons, right, you're getting back to the fact that design is real, that it's not an optional extra, that it's not coming in at the end and waving a prettiness wand over things, that it is the product itself, that it makes money. It's not a cost. It makes money. That you say in the book, the designer, you will make, if something's well designed, you will make much more from it than the designer ever did. For people who are afraid that, like, why should I pay this person $100,000? It's like, well, because you're going to make a million.
Right. You are going, you know, I've told clients before, you are going to make 100 times more money on this website than I am. So let's keep this in mind.
I actually had the experience of designing something at Happy Cog for $90,000 and then having the client the next month sell it for $20 million.
There you go.
And I was like, and we kind of felt like chumps, I have to say. Like, wow, you know, I would have designed it for free for like a percentage. But I was like, they had nothing. Before we redesigned it, they had they had a lot of hits, right? They had all that kind of stuff. They had stuff that people wanted. They had lots of eyeballs, but they didn't have, the product looked like a 20-year-old plastered or 15-year-old plastered together, you know, 8,000 server side includes missing. I mean, just it was a total mess, and we fixed it for them and we made it beautiful, and then they sold it for $20 million. Not that I'm bitter. So yeah, but it's,
you should
it's
be
proof.
Happy about that. That's a fantastic success story.
I agree. And, although, you know, a taste would be nice. I don't get to dip my beak.
I mean, in the end, I mean, all of these arguments that designers try to avoid with their clients, like, all of those get forgotten once the site launches and everything goes well. You know, I've never had, and say, you know what, I'm still pissed off about that typeface that you jammed down my throat. They call and say, wow, our numbers are good.
Although there is that entropy thing that happens sometimes when you're a consulting designer, where you come in, you work on something for 6 months, you really fix it up, you leave, and then you come back a year later and it's somehow deteriorated because a lot of decisions were made that you weren't there to participate in because you weren't there anymore, basically.
And so, one of the things that we try to do with clients, that we do with clients, is we figure out how they work. I think a lot of that, I mean, there's a lot of natural entropy in websites and, you know, most other things, human bodies. But our goal, I mean, any fool can have a website look great on launch day. And it can look great for a month after launch day even. But our goal is to make sure that we're delivering a website that's going to look
great on day like 435 by making sure that we understand how people are working on it, the amount of people that are working on it, and the amount of time they have to work on it, and so that we're designing something tailored to the environment that's going to maintain it. And then making sure that we leave them with an owner's manual to keep it well maintained.
Do you call those style guides, or do you have a new, more modern?
We call those owner's manuals.
Owner's manuals.
Yeah.
How much your partner and co-founder, Erica Hall, is also a writer, and she's really a writer. How much does having a writer...
Like I'm not.
You are a writer, but you're a designer who writes great books.
I actually think I'm a writer who happens to design on the side at this point.
Okay. I hear you on that, but initially, you're a designer.
Sure.
How to have a writer as a founding partner at your design studio?
It's great. I mean, what is the web made of? What are websites made of? They're made of words for the most part.
Do you remember
You gotta understand how words work. I've dealt with a ton of designers in my time who were like, these are words. I'm going to lorem ipsum them. Somebody can come in later and fill them in.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, dude, learn how to write.
It used to, again, because I have a writing background too, it used to really, and I love reading and I love writing, it bothered me tremendously back in the late 90s, early 2000s, when the award-winning style, the style that clients seemed eager to buy and that designers seemed eager to reward, was there'd be like a tiny little square, maybe with a flash, an inset box with like 7-point Helvetica or 7-point Arial, sorry, with a little flash scroller. And that would be the textual content of the website. And the rest of it was like this giant background of a destroyed world or a robot or whatever. And it was an illustration embedded in flash with some embedded text that wasn't readable. And there was just sort of, I don't know if it was from Ray Gun or where people got it from, but it was like contempt for the word. I think starting around the early 2000s, we had like Dean Allen writing in A List Apart about writing for readers, and Mandy Brown writing about writing for readers. It's really important. It's really important. Like designing for readers, sorry, not writing for readers, designing for readers. Designing for readers seems like such an obvious use case for the web. And it took like 15 years for web design, for that to become a mainstream web design idea. It's now, finally you look and you can like, there's type and you can read it and there's big paragraphs. And so it looks like art directors had some say, and instead of like designers had some say,
The web in its most natural core state is made of words. How can you work on the web and say, I'm not good at words?
Well, you could say, I'm really great at jQuery, so bite me. I'll do the coding and somebody else can figure out the words. I mean, that's a legitimate thing to say.
I don't think so.
You think everyone who works developer, no matter what you do, you need to be able to persuade?
Yes, because at some point, you are going to have to somebody that the work you did was right. And somebody who can do pretty good work and persuade a client that it's right will always win out over somebody who's doing fantastic work and sitting there with their mouth shut. Work has never in the history of design sold itself. That is the biggest lie that people tell you. It always comes down to persuading somebody that this is right.
I think that's absolutely true, but there is a one caveat. There are directors who make films appreciated only by a very small, a tiny filmmaking public. There are designers who make, who starve and eke out a living and are very much admired by other designers. There are almost like an art, you know, getting more toward the art side and away from the science or the applied craft, you know, the job of it. There are people who, you know, are cult figures, right? I mean, you could look at Tom Waits and say he's a genius, or you could say that guy didn't write successful songs like Billy Joel. In a weird way, a successful designer is more like Billy Joel. I'm not liking where this is going at all. Help me out here.
This is going to a really bad place. I think Tom Waits writes exactly the songs that he wants to write. He knows exactly what he's doing because it's art, and he's
appreciated by people who like literature and the craft of song and alcoholics. And Johnny Depp, but he's not mainstream, and he never will be. That's okay. I still don't like where this is going.
If he wanted to be mainstream, I have no doubt that he could figure that out.
Actually, he could. Yeah, because he had a few early on. He had some almost like The Boss. In fact, Springsteen covered some of his early songs, and so did the Eagles.
He found the place where he wanted to be, and he figured out how to do the best work in that place. I mean, you could say that I'm not a successful designer because I'm not working at Facebook, which has like the biggest user base in the world.
Right? So I really don't like where that's going either.
I mean, that's where that analogy is going.
Yeah, that's going in the trash.
All right. So why should you buy this book to give to somebody else?
That's got to be a hurdle for you as an author, right? Usually we write books, if we write them, for someone to read. We don't write them for someone to give away. It's sort of like, give this to your daughter so she'll understand puberty, instead of, here's a book for you as a woman.
Actually, there's a huge history of...
I know, and those are terrible books. And those are terrible books that did a terrible job, right? So, right, I'm right there with you. But in this case... You're saying give this to your client and it's a good book. How do you overcome someone's fear of, I don't want to insult my client? I've actually had people say about who haven't read the book, but we're just looking at it like, I'd be afraid to give this to my client because what if they think I'm saying they're not a good client? I have to teach them how to be a client. Isn't that condescending of me? What do you say to that? How do you correct that?
I say you face it head on. You say, hey, if you've never worked with a design studio before, then, you know, this book will have some insights on, you know, how to keep us honest.
And if you have had unsatisfying results, right? If you have worked with a designer before, but it hasn't really worked out, this book could also have insightful thoughts.
Right.
What's the next book?
I don't know. I'm still trying to sell this one.
I understand that, but you wrote Design as a Job, which was for the designer. And now you've written You're My Favorite Client, which is for the client. Do you have something in mind?
I think the next one might be on persuasion, on selling.
We all need a lot of help with that.
I'm hearing from a lot of people, even like small studio owners, that their designers need help selling. They were never trained on how to sell work.
By selling,
I mean, you know, persuading a client that the work that I've done is right, not, you know, going out and finding clients.
Right. And you don't mean forcing something down their throat because it'll win you an award. You mean doing the work that's right and then persuading a nervous client that, in fact, you know, even if you don't like green and this is green, this is right. And the green is part of why it's right. And here's why, I believe, is what you're talking about. That's the hard thing for all of us. I mean, you keep going back to taste in You're My Favorite Client, but that is still a huge problem. I have people. And I've been doing this a long time and I have good clients. I still have people who say, yeah, I just don't like, or I prefer this. And it doesn't matter what else I say. They're happy saying that they prefer something.
What would you tell me if we were having it? Like if you were telling me that story, like if this just happened to you, you went in, you pitched something, they gave you the, oh, I just don't like this color. And then we were to have coffee after that presentation, what would you tell me?
Oh, I'd tell you that I persuaded them by saying it doesn't matter what you like. It matters what the user base likes. And here's the research. And we know what they like. And you know what? You're selling underwear to a millennial and you're 65. You don't know what they like.
Yeah.
So let's both, and neither do I, by the way. I'm too old also. So let's not let our middle-aged bullshit get in the way of doing our jobs. That's what I would say.
So in general, like the way that usually happens is, you know, a designer will come back to me and go, you know, presentation didn't go the way I wanted it, blah, blah, blah. They were pissed off about this. They didn't like that, blah, blah, blah. And I'll ask, well, why do you think that was the right thing to show? And they'll give me like all the reasons. And I'll say, why didn't you tell the client that? Well, I feel like I can talk to you that way, but I can't talk to them that way. And that's the problem right there. People don't.
So you got another book in you.
People don't feel like they can be honest with the client. People, you know, to do client services correctly, you have to recognize that you are the equal of your client and that you two can talk to each other like human beings. You know, like we can talk to each other here in the studio. If most people try to sell up to a client, they're like, oh, the client, you know,
they're diplomatic. They're diplomatic.
Yeah. Don't be diplomatic.
I've seen really brilliant UX and IA people and designers do that sort of present it humbly. Like they're someone talking to a king.
Humility is incredibly expensive.
These are good tweets, by the way.
I know.
Had they come out on Twitter. Humility is incredibly expensive.
Is incredibly expensive. Your client needs to be reassured at every moment that they hired the right person. They need to be reassured that you know what you're doing. They need to be reassured that check they wrote to you was written to the right person. And when you come in and you present work and you're all like shy and quiet, all of that stuff is being questioned. They're wondering, oh, actually know what they're doing. They're being so humble. Your confidence is not something that you do for yourself. It's, you know, if nothing else, do it for your client because they need to be confident that they hired the right designer. And if they see that confidence in you, then they will be confident in that decision and they will be confident in the work that you're doing.
That is a great place to end our show. I hate to do it, but our time is up. The author is Mike Montero and the book is You're My Favorite Client with a foreword by Austin Kleon. It's from abookapart.com. Buy it direct. Buy it by the box load for your clients. Michael, thank you for your time. I called you Michael. What the hell? Thank you for your time today.
Thank you for having me on, Jeffrey.
And everyone, thank you for listening. And we'll be back soon with another Big Web Show. Bye-bye.